This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Sheriff Chris Nanos says the focus has shifted heavily to digital evidence and DNA. He's talking about thousands and thousands of surveillance videos and an unidentified DNA contributor that could still crack the case. Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent, is back with us to help us walk through what is happening behind the scenes and where the next big break is most likely to come from. I think that's what everybody is waited with bated breath for. Hopefully there will be this big break. If there is to be a big break or some sort of break, even a small break at this point would be welcome beyond the speculation that we've all been doing now for roughly 5 months. If we're going to get a break, where is it going to come from, Jen?
You know, I still think the number one piece of evidence is Porch Guy's face. I know somebody knows exactly who that is. And it could be that they just don't know about this case. I think oftentimes we think because we're true crimers and newsies that, you know, there is information that everybody knows what we know, but people don't. They're so busy with their lives. So that could be one of the cases. The other thing, of course, is they're scared to death to say anything. But nevertheless, I think that's number one. Number two, I do like the videos, but again, this is nothing new. They've been doing that from minute one, trying to figure out. What I cannot fathom is in this time frame we have from 2:30 in the morning, such a finite time frame. I find it odd that they cannot narrow down at least some image of a vehicle. The hair, I think, is problematic, although, you know, I always try to be optimistic because hairs are transient. As we've discussed, that thing could be from a grocery store clerk that got on the bag, that got in there. You know, they're so transient. But we have to remain hopeful that if they even are able to decipher who it is via genetic genealogy, which could take months, that it comes back to somebody that's related to Porch Guy.
Are there any interviews you'd actually redo again or that you direct, like that private eye or anyone else to re-interview or even the FBI at this point with what they know now? Because, and we discussed this early on, you know, once you get a little more data, when you re-engage people, you have a little bit more directed questions you can ask, get a little bit more baseline, a little more understanding. At this point, do you think they should or have already gone back and re-interviewed any specific people or in the surroundings or even, you know, workers, anything that you think would break it on the human side versus the cyber side?
You know, when you look at the videos that we've seen over and over again of the different canvases that have been done in both Annie's neighborhood and in Nancy's neighborhood, it's, to me, kind of concerning. I mean, they were out there so many times, different canvases. And so I would not want to do that because I think what happens is over time, people's memories tend to get not only stale, but they tend to sort of almost imagine things that happen.
Yeah, false memories start. Yep.
And that's a huge problem. So I would be reluctant about those kinds of people. I think it would be very interesting to make sure that I knew from the church group that she was close to and anyone else she's close to that maybe we don't hear about, anything that Nancy might have said. I know these questions had to have been asked, but if somebody's remembered something along the road, now when that's a lot different than I think the neighborhood canvases, I think that that could be important.
Yeah, I agree. The leakage over time after you reflect is really key and critical because those teeny little wobbles can be noticed in hindsight so much clearer when you actually have some distance from the emotional attachment to it. I'm also curious. Tony, I know you're going to say something.
You're good.
I'm also curious. You know what I'm really shocked at? And Tony, I know you're looking at this too because it's your hometown. In the sense of Walmart headquarters, I'm really shocked they haven't been able to come up with anything for purchases on that stuff. Are you, Jen?
Well, initially I would have agreed, but Walmart is so huge. I did a deep dive into that It's amazing how many millions of customers a day. I think if you look at that, it's unbelievable. And then, of course, I was tracking even Mexico, because right. Mexico, I believe Walmart is their biggest retailer. And I just think there is so much to go through on this, on these backpacks, since they're only made there. I still don't think that's a dead end, though. I really don't think it's a dead end.
That's good.
There's so much to go through, so many receipts to try to narrow down. So whenever you're dealing with millions and millions of receipts to look through on that backpack, it just is going to take these analysts, and that's who's doing it, everybody. It's not the people that are the investigators. I believe that work is all being done behind the scenes by the analysts.
And I know this happened after we both got out. You know, there was no such thing as AI being employed with us in law enforcement before we retired. But do you think that they have the ability to take all those receipts and plug it into an AI thing? Because, I mean, Mike Grock could probably suck that in and look at it in 5 seconds and kind of see if there's a grouping of any purchases like that anywhere. Do you think they have that resource now that they're using, or no?
You know, I think Walmart has that.
Yeah, there and you go. Right.
Kind of like with Google. You know, they're the technicians. They know their systems the best. I would be very convinced that Walmart is working hand in hand with the Bureau to try to see if they can narrow that focus down.
I mean, you'd really have to. I mean, backpacks alone are going to be a very broad brush to find. It literally is the biggest retailer on the planet. You'd be looking, obviously, you'd want to be, I think, looking in the Tucson general area. There's only so many Walmarts there. I have no idea what the number is, but I'm going to guess 10 to 20 stores somewhere in that general number. I don't know. I think we got 10 to 20 here in Northwest Arkansas. But you're talking that. You're looking at those receipts. So you got the backpack. Then maybe be looking at other equipment that may be used or may have been used, or clothing that may have been on said person. If you can find all those things and narrow it down to one single purchaser, but then you're also going to be relying on how did they purchase the product? Was it on a credit card? Was it cash? Was it even in a Walmart? But if we're just at a Walmart where they're getting it, then you would have to be also looking at, okay, you have the information, you have likely, if it was bought in store, your camera or multiple cameras that would be on that person buying. And if they paid with a credit card, that would put some information there. But here's, maybe this is a legal question, but you guys could probably answer it too. What sort of rights do purchasers of products have with something like this to not have their identity given over to the FBI or a criminal investigation for something like this? I mean, does that take some sort of a court order or a subpoena or something to Walmart to reveal customers' identities and purchase history and such for people that have not been charged with a crime?
Subpoena.
Okay.
I mean, there's multiple kinds of subpoenas, right? There's a grand jury subpoena, and yeah. Then we also have admin subpoenas, but those are typically just used in narcotic and organized crime trafficking, where literally, as the case agent, you write it out, your supervisor signs off on it, and you go serve it. So the subpoena process, even if it's a grand jury subpoena, is extremely easy. You just have to be working with the local United States Attorney's Office, and you can get one in a couple hours.
Yeah.
But yes, they're going to have to do that 100% just to have the legal authority. And then secondarily, whenever you're doing a case, you are doing it as if you were thinking about trial.
Yeah.
Do a case any other way than that, worried about what this is going to look like in trial. That's how you have to do all these cases. So they're going to be dotting these I's, crossing the T's for sure, Tony.
And typically what we do is funny, as you're saying that, Jen's like, wow, a lot of times I just go in and ask a source. But the trial thing is what you got to watch out for. So we would typically ask ahead of time, is this something we'd be able to get if we had this? So that you're not going to waste time on the paper. But yeah, 100%.
What about this in terms of the evidence? And we're waiting for a break here of some sort. And sometimes in many cases that go cold and it takes years to solve them. It's not that it could have been solved if somebody had looked the right way or looked under the right hole 5 years ago. It's that the technology didn't exist for us to be able to examine the evidence and the information at that point in time. What should they be thinking about right now in this investigation that maybe we don't have the technology for quite yet, but maybe coming up 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, that may be able to help identify more information about who was on the porch, who was in Nancy's house that day, that maybe we're just not quite there yet on? Or have we checked the boxes and we're going as far as we can in terms of identifying people through, mitochondrial DNA and things of that nature? Are there things on the horizon that we should be thinking about here? Preserve them, because this may be our linchpin 5 years down the road if we're still at a dead end.
This is one of my favorite questions, because one of the biggest things is this mixed DNA sample, which is not the hair. Mm-hmm. It's be something else, where there, according to Nanos in an interview, he said more than two contributors. And right now in DNA, they cannot separate out more than two. They can do two, but they can't do three or more. And that is one of the biggest things they're working on. That's going to be the aha moment that I think is around the horizon that could help with this case. We don't know whether that's spit, which I still think, because he had that bite light, there has to be his spit all over that place, because when he put it out, took it out, it's on his gloves, and then now he transfers it. Again, we've talked about, I'll forever be just dumbfounded as to why they did not take the vines, because that was commensurate with him putting bite light in and out and then touching the vines. And then obviously we've also talked about how he stood over the mat and they didn't take the mat. It's not that I don't think they didn't process it, but there's so much more that could have been there if they just ended up taking a few swabs. So very concerning there, but that's the piece that I think, if they truly have this mixed sample, could crack the case down the road.
On a technology side, aside from the biogenetic kind of stuff that's going to keep advancing, that they'll do better at, I'm also looking at vehicles. You know, vehicles being wired and vehicles being connected, kind of like smart car, you know, the whatchamacallit, Teslas are, that is getting more and more prevalent. So I also think that as time passes in the future, us being able to track every single vehicle in and out of an area and then establishing that timeline and then look for blips, kind of like we look for cell phone traffic data in and out of an area. But it's easier to turn off a cell phone than it is to turn off a car if they're going to use some sort of vehicle. So I think over time, our ability to kind of zero in and to vehicle anomalies in an area, unless they did everything on foot, which I know one of the theories out there is one of the abandoned houses or house for sale or whatever, but I still think vehicles in the future is going to be even more helpful for us.
And crossing the data with the vehicle information, the vehicle technology information that's showing it, where a vehicle was, where it's not. Number one, they'd have to have a vehicle that does that. Not all vehicles are capable of
eventually.
That. But if they did have one that was, again, I mean, I too am a bit baffled here, Jen. I mean, at some point, there's going to be cameras. There are cameras that show comings and goings from this general area of town.
Maybe.
But I guess how have we not gone anywhere with a vehicle yet? I mean, maybe that's the $10,000 question that nobody really knows the answer to. But I am kind of baffled that there's not at least been like a pool of people that have been looked at. Or have they? It was that the first arrests that we saw in those first couple of days where they detained people and it turned out they had nothing to do with this? Was that the initial lever that was pulled and it turned out the obvious ones that were on the cameras were not in fact the people? I don't know.
I think those first two people were in the spotlight because of their appearance, and people in their circle somehow thinking they were Porch Guy, but by not only the way they looked, but also different things going on in their lives, that, you know, in terms of their jobs, in terms of the delivery situation, one losing their house, another being apparently a little bit in the criminal world, things like that. And so they had to clear them, clear it up one way or the other, that they were involved or they weren't involved. But back to this car notion. So there is a map out there, and you can go about 23 minutes and basically get out of that neighborhood and avoid lights. So if you turn your car off, you could just be tooling around. And even if people have Nest or Ring, and again, these cars are way off the road where you would be going, there was only one portion of this roadway where there was a school and there were a couple lights there. But if you're all darked out, blacked out, which that's what I would be doing, you can go a long way without hitting road. But sooner or later, you have to hit a road. You have to hit a highway or a thoroughfare to get out of it.
What about cell phones? I mean, that was the other thing here. I mean, initially, early on, it seemed, you know, I don't know, I had a lot more confidence they were going to figure this out at the early stages. I think a lot of us did, because the thought process was, okay, combine a couple things, the digital purchase, the digital history, if we could find that, combined with cell phone tower data of somebody in the area. Cell phone tower data has done a lot for other cases. I'm thinking of Koberger. I'm thinking of, okay, we were able to show that your vehicle pinged here. If there was a cell phone, there's only so many cell phones that ping off of a tower that is close to Nancy Guthrie's home. So if they had a cell phone, one of those pings belongs, or several of the pings belong, to the people who were at that house. But then the thought process of tracking all of those pings down might be a little difficult. I suppose you could cancel out some of the folks who have always been there every day, where their phones are just charging at night and pinging, and you could see the pattern there. I don't know. It just seems like there should be a way to cipher through this data and see some of the outliers that are not normally pinging in this area and go, okay, let's parse through these folks and see what we can find.
I don't think they used any cell phones. I don't think they had them in the area.
I
really think it was a two-way radio, HD. And these are so, you can use these so well covertly, where you just have to squelch. You just have to squeeze it and you can say yes, and squeeze it twice and say no.
Yeah.
So they're critical. And I tell you, that photo, I can see the antenna.
Yeah, you've always said that you thought that is a two-way, right?
Yep, I'm really convinced of that.
And I'm with you. You know, just the vibe you get off of that. This, if they even had cell phones, him or multiples, these would be burners. These would be something that would probably be bought in that Walmart purchase, and then their use of them. These do not look like cell phone users to me. And it's not because of being sleuth. I just don't think they have the capability.
But who's not a cell phone user today, Rob? I mean, I don't even...
You'd be surprised. So when you are, and Jen has much more experience doing criminal activities than I did in the Bureau.
Yeah, give me, expand on that.
So anytime we did an operation, I mean, I kept upstairs in my house here. I had like four or five burner phones that were bought from random places over a period of time. And if you're about to do an operation, we would activate a burner phone. Okay. And then we would activate it and we would use activations from other places in the country. So it would mask it. And then when you bought it with, you know, an undercover ID, it's masked even more. So, I mean, use of burner phones for operations like this, and this is just a couple of wonks like me doing it. So, and if you have someone that's doing criminal activity, that's exactly what you're doing. And then all you do, you know, so then if you think about it, first you're using burner phones that were purchased in other areas around the country. And then if they had maybe three marbles rolling around upstairs and not two, they turn it off in the area. So they do a Koberger, which was he was using his own phone, but turn it off, which is obvious as living hell. But these guys, if they're turning them off, just like Koberger, and they're licensed someplace else, and it's very, very hard. So even if they did, even if they were able to identify a cell phone blip in the wobble, being able to track it back to an individual, because if it was purchased somewhere else in the country, it was initiated, you know, it's so easy to get a burner phone and not in true name somewhere else. That's why.
I mean, and that tells us more about the suspect themselves then as well. I mean, you have your, we see so many cases where the suspect's cell phone is literally their cell phone, is registered to them. That would tell us that somebody thought far enough ahead to be using a burner device for whatever their purpose was here, that that's some level of sophistication. That doesn't take much. You can go to the Dollar General and buy your burner phone. But it is a thought process. It's more than just I'm running around here this weekend and I'm going to go rob some stuff from old people and this went horribly wrong. It does show a level of planning and sophistication and certainly a concerted effort not to get caught.
You know, listen, this guy is likely a mope, as we called them in the FBI.
I agree.
But this mope did a lot of things right. Whether he got enough of television, whether he thought, what do I need for my costume? And he put it together, because that's what it looks like with the mismatched holster and the, it's a cheap affair, definitely, that he's rigged out in. But he thought through everything. And then he had a lot of factors that helped him environmentally. That how that's obscured with all of those trees, the deepness and darkness of night, all of that played into this. And, you know, I've been more and more believe that this could be, you know, something where the puppeteer is more very organized. I've talked about French attacks. This being a modification of one of those, would not surprise me.
And that's what I want to get into here next. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on where things are at with the evidence in the Nancy Guthrie investigation. Go ahead and drop it there. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Well, here we go. We're going to talk about Nancy Guthrie again, get an update, discuss where things are at or where they're not at. Crime scene was released too early. The thermal imaging plane sat aground. The lead sergeant had never worked a homicide. Experienced detectives had already been sidelined. The doorbell footage was declared unrecoverable until the FBI recovered it. And the sheriff leading all this has a documented grudge against the very agency that was supposed to help him. Every one of those failures, they have a name attached to him. To it, the question isn't just what went wrong, it's why, and whether this case can survive what has been done to it. Now that we are, seven, eight? What? How many weeks in are we now, guys? I don't even, do we know?
Infinity and beyond.
I think eight? No, I don't know. I think we're on day 70-something.
I think it's at least 8 or 9 weeks, right?
My God. I mean, it's the beginning of the year, and here we are. We're almost into May. Yeah. Jennifer Coffin-Daffer, retired FBI special agent, is our guest. And of course, as always with me, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. I want to start here. I want to start with a tweet that we started with this morning that we all had joined in on. Jen, you had posted on the internets about the thoughts from Nanos directly that Nanos knew the motive, or that law enforcement knew the motive going in. Another wild claim that, of course, has come out of the mouth of Nanos over time. And I think my response was something of, I don't believe anything this man says that he knew anything. I guess I want to start there, Jen, with Nanos, because it's one of many claims that he's made. Do you buy it? Do you think they know the motive? Or do you think this is just more lip service and just more things that came out of his mouth from the man who's not used to people holding him accountable for his words?
It's a good question. You know, I've always said at the backbone of these cases, at least from my vantage, I always try to post the facts as disseminated by law enforcement as the crux of our fact basis, right?
Yeah.
In other words, sources, we never even know who they are. At least we know who he is. We also know he's in the know, right? He has access. He's running the investigation alongside the FBI. In this particular quote that I took from one of his press conferences, he specifically says, we've always had the motive. It was what they thought from the beginning. And so then you look at that and you say, well, what corroborates that? And what corroborated that were a couple of things. One was a statement by Savannah Guthrie. Number two was the fact that on the 2nd, that was when the first message was sent, email was sent to the locals. We just didn't know about it because they didn't say anything. Uh-huh. And then finally, you know, it went to TMZ on the 3rd, so we knew about it. I don't think the ransom request was worth for anything. In other uh-huh. words, it was more to punish this family because by then she was already dead, so it wasn't really for money. But I think from how I saw him deliver that, he believes they know and that it was a ransom.
So what is the motive? And according to, is it just cruelty? Cruelty to Savannah Guthrie? Is that what he believes it is? Or that he believes he's known from day one?
No, I think he thinks from day one it was a ransom.
Okay.
And then the cruelty came after she died, which, come on, we all knew you can't kidnap an 84-year-old with health issues, which they all have, and expect them to live.
Yeah.
That's why I still, this is just, there's so little actual data and facts, and it's just all over. So we go, I mean, how many times are you going to keep saying, we keep going down the road of, all right, we're doing it. The intent is to make money. And they completely screwed that up this way, sideways, upside down. And even with, and Jen, you've been posting this too. I thought this was a great idea. So if this is actually real, if they actually think this is real, and one of these nut jobs is actually the real ransomer, and I'm highly skeptical of that to begin with too, then why not give a little something to find her body, to recover the body? Because if they wanted to make money, you have to be able to provide that. Even if you can't give sign of life at this point, if the intent was money, but now we're not getting that, which is weird. And then now if the secondary intent is cruelty, okay, but there's a lot of other better ways to do that as well, more effective ways. There's no other leakage. That's why this whole thing is just bifurcated, strange to me. And kind of following up with that, I'm curious, and you posted this as well, and I wholeheartedly agree. I'm curious, BAU's not weighed in as far as we know. Now, they might have consulted, and that's why I'm curious what you're hearing. Generally, if BAU consults on things, they're not going to publicize it. The sheriff's department, someone else is going to publicize that they weighed in on it. But in cases where they, and we saw this on Tony and also Jen when we covered the yogurt shop murders many years ago, mm-hmm. and BAU came in on that and they refused to actually do a consultation really because they didn't have enough data. They didn't have enough evidence. And so Jen, I'm curious if BAU is either, are they weighing in and the sheriff's not saying it? Did they come in, say, we don't have enough to say anything? Or they came in, weighed it, and said, you know, it's just not fitting any of these patterns. That it's kind of where I'm at on this. Is that's why I'm like, I'm open to everything, because every time you go down a road, boof. Every time you this road, boof. And so where do you think it is with BAU?
I 100% think they weighed in. And I think that they were able to weigh in based on the ransom notes that they had on day 2 and day 3 and day 5. And also on him, looking at him, just like with Luigi, that we could tell so much in terms of economically what that guy was about. You could tell so much about his age, you know, using the hostels, all those little data points, as you put it, that really could give a profile of him. I think we have the same profile contributors here, particularly with that ransom note. Robin, I used the BAU 3 times. All 3 times, they were absolutely spot on.
Oh, yeah. That's why I keep going to their research as well, 100%. Because, again, they're using research and background and data from all these things. But there's also a difference, and I'm curious whether they, you know, inside, I mean, you know, this is more for the audience than anything else. So inside a CIRG, Critical Incidents Response Group, you have the BAUs, and last I was in, there was 4 different BAUs, 1, 2, 3, and 4, each with a different specialty. And then you also have the crisis negotiators, which are actually separate, but it's still inside CIRG. So I was thinking that the crisis negotiators are the ones that are actually working with, you know, and these guys like Chris Voss and Never Split the Difference. Those are the ones actually working on the statement analysis and working with the ransom note. Or the BAUs? How does that, because I actually never worked with them directly in my cases because our team did different things. How do you think that worked, the dynamic worked?
I think they would both have been consulted, as you said, and you just bring up a great point. You have your hostage negotiators, but to me, hostage negotiators in large part are get their information from other agents. In other words, from the case agents, they're the ones though that know how to communicate and how to make the best interaction with the hostage taker. Right. So it's that skill combined with the behavioral analysis unit's knowledge of behavior that is combined, in my opinion, that would make the right nexus for the what would have been communicated by the family. But I think BAU is all over this sucker.
Yeah, I would hope so. And I'll tell you, and that's why, even from the get-go, I thought the communication that Nancy and the family, well, I mean, Savannah and the family was doing was really spot on. They covered so many different angles that would appeal to so many different people, I thought. And you could see their origin of what they wanted to say, then tweaked and fine-tuned by these master crafters. But yeah, anyway.
So if we're looking back here, and let's play along with Nanos for a moment, and he knows the motive, and the motive was ransom. Obviously, that didn't happen, even though they said they'd pay, dead or alive. And it's not to criticize, you know, Savannah or her family or anything doing anything wrong or right. I mean, just what if they knew this motive, and this was the motive all along, it was to get ransom, and then they offered it, and these notes originally were authentic. If what went wrong? What could have been done differently that may have produced a different outcome? Or did they do everything right, and just the other side, the people who have Nancy, just chose not to participate at some point?
Yeah, good question.
I think a couple of things. First of all, I can't imagine the spot this family must have been in on the spot with all of their emotions completely overwhelming them. And they're supposed to make a life and death decision on the spot, especially now that we know the first ransoms came in on day two. Mm-hmm. Right. So after 24 to 48 hours, that's when the ones went to the local station. So now they're supposed to come up with $6 million. They're supposed to try to figure out why they're going to a news outlet, and they're listening to what the FBI is saying. And I can tell you, the FBI, this is my opinion, they did not recommend giving any money without proof of life. That is just what mm-hmm. I think the recommendation was. On top of that, we've talked about this a little bit, but if you have $40 million or your net worth is that, that means if you sell your stuff, you sell your stocks, you sell your investments, it does not mean you have $60 million underneath your mattress. You're not going to have it in bank accounts unless you have a lot of bank accounts. It's only FDIC insured for $250,000, I believe, most banks. So think money is, as we all know, it's when you have money, you're making it work. Mm-hmm. And so I think the time span was too short. Remember, they had only till the 5th and then the 9th. So that is not a lot of time. And again, you're making this huge decision and there's no proof of life. What I wish is that they would have thrown, like I'm suggesting right now, throw in half a Bitcoin, 37, tickle the wire. You and I know, and I've never talked about this to give the number, Robin, case funds is a huge number. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm also curious, you know, just going to the perpetrator of this, again, if the intent is the money, why did they use the most unconventional, never used methodology, which again goes against the profile of someone doing this, which is going through media and not a direct contact? What was the intent of that, do you think?
Oh, I think when they asked for money, at that point, again, I'm down to just being cruel. I mean, they knew that the FBI, this is my opinion, I think they knew they weren't going to get a dime. They knew exactly what I'm saying. Just like everybody knows, if you don't have proof of life or proof of death, uh-huh. the FBI is going to support that. And they are going to work with what the FBI is recommending, typically speaking. And they're an emotional wreck at that point. So you add that all together, Robin, I just think it was cruel. And I think it was those people wanting to be in control of the narrative and have everybody see them on center stage.
So now we are getting reports, TMZ, you know, they went too long without having a good story. So suddenly they're getting they're getting ransom notes again. How legit do you think these things are? You were just talking about that half a Bitcoin offer that seems to be out there. Let's talk about that and entertaining that. I mean, Bitcoin is somewhat traceable. I have no idea what sort of resources, you know, I would imagine the FBI has far greater resources than you or I have at trying to track something like that. Why don't they? I mean, at the very least, there's someone to go arrest. I mean, if you can trace it down. I mean, but if they, there's got to be ways that they're expecting to collect this Bitcoin and not be traced. So I don't think it's just as easy as, well, send the money and see what happens or where it goes. It may go absolutely nowhere. And I don't know that you're ever going to truly find where it went. Or am I wrong on that? Is there a way that they could figure this out on the back end?
And even, and throw more on that. So sorry, Jen, we're going to inundate you. You know, and Savannah said they would. I don't understand, like you, why, because they actually make the ultimate call whether they're going to pay anything or not. Why not risk that? Because it seems, I mean, why wouldn't you?
This is a no-brainer for me. And, you know, we make calls on cases like this all the time with case funds. Yes, you had to get everybody to approve it. But we made a lot of calls like this, particularly in narcotic cases and organized crime cases. In other words, you have to be willing. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been at a bank getting $1 million out. That's the FBI's money. And we're taking a risk that things are going to go smoothly with the surveillance on it. We're going to track it. And so this is not new to the FBI. The FBI is very good at this. And when it comes to Bitcoin, Tony, there are these chains that are easily followed. And it's public knowledge. The problem is Batman could be at the end of that chain. So now you have a ghost that took it out. But there are documented cases. And I actually am going to go on Twitter and post a documented case about how it can be done. So once they take it out, if they're going to make it liquid, it has to go through a traceable unit. It's from it becomes dead.
And that has even a higher probability than some of the cases I worked in the counterintelligence world. I mean, there was cases in New York many decades ago when I was first there where we actually were doing recruitment ops where we got approved, you know, you put diamonds and some non-traceable things under windshield wipers of intelligence officers with a note, you know, knowing the probability of that stuff walking was pretty high, but you're always willing to take that risk of the potential reward. So it's interesting here. Why aren't they willing? Why isn't someone willing to take a risk for a potential reward of just her body? Just bring her home, like Savannah kept saying. I'm with you. I don't get why no one's doing more. There's certainly going to be more done. That's because there's a moron at top running this.
Just think, Robin, all of the money that is being spent on this case. We saw the Senate added up in Gabby Petito looking for Brian Laundrie. It was millions and millions and millions of dollars in assets. I can't remember the exact million-dollar figure, but it was multi-gazillion dollars. And they're not willing to spend a freaking half of a Bitcoin to tickle the wire here. I am stunned.
Me too. You know, it all comes down, you know, and sorry, you know, it's showing how the sausage is made. So it all comes down to these pots of money, right? That's how the world thinks inside the bureaucracy. Well, we have all this overtime we can pay. And since agents don't get paid overtime, it doesn't really count. You just get paid one salary. So we can easily use salary here. But this has actually got to come out of discretionary funds when this is actually don't have as much discretionary funds. So we can't spend $10,000 here, but we can pay $100,000 in supposed overtime. It just makes no sense.
Guys, I think we're forgetting the most important thing here. Cash Patel has a girlfriend who is a singing sensation that he needs to go see. So, I mean, there's money that needs to go to fly him to whatever Indian casino that she may be performing at in the lounge on a Thursday after the buffet empties at 8:30 and you can get 2-for-1s on the slots. That money needs to go there. I mean, what are we thinking? I mean, this is insane. Why would we want to spend this on an investigation into a kidnapping and a murder when you need to fly that around? I mean, come on, pots of America. Money.
That's the Gulfstream pot of money.
Yeah, America. Let's talk about another aspect of this case, and let's get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Out at McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken meal deal o un $6 McDouble meal deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.